This episode of the Robot Report podcast is brought to you by Robo Business Direct, an ongoing digital series where you'll hear from the brightest minds in robotics. Robo Business Direct continues March 18th at 2 p.m. Eastern. Join DHL, Intel, and Waypoint Robotics to learn about the challenges and keys to successfully scaling autonomous mobile robots from pilot projects to autonomous fleets. You'll learn about integration with existing infrastructure, interoperation with existing automation processes, case studies about configuration and deployment, and much more. Again, it all kicks off March 18th at 2 p.m. Eastern. To register and check out the full schedule, visit robobusinessdirect.com. What's up, everyone? Welcome to episode 37 of the Robot Report podcast, which brings conversations with robotics innovators straight to you. I'm Steve Crow, editor of the Robot Report. Thanks, as always, for tuning in. You can find the podcast on Amazon Music, Apple Podcasts, Google Play, SoundCloud, Spotify, anywhere you get your podcasts. Please subscribe, leave us a rating, give us a review. A quick announcement before we dive into things here. A bunch of folks have been reaching out asking about when we're opening the nominations process for the 2021 RBR 50 Innovation Awards. We'll be opening up that process next week, so stay tuned and be on the lookout for that. If you don't know what the RBR 50 is, it's our annual innovation list from our sister publication, Robotics Business Review. It's been around for about a decade now and honors technology, business, and market innovations for the global robotics industry. And the best part, there's no cost to enter this program. So again, be on the lookout for the opening of the nominations process. We'll announce it on the podcast here. We'll also announce it on the Robot Report and Robotics Business Review as well. So we have a great show for you today. I'll play my conversation with Juan Aparicio later on. He's now VP of Product at Ready Robotics. Certainly, you probably know him from his decade-plus leading industrial automation efforts at Siemens. I'll also recap the week that was in robotics, including an update on the NASA Perseverance rover. But we're joined now by one of the best in the business, Enrico Krug-Everson, the CEO and co-founder of On Robot, of course, a leading end-of-arm tool provider. Certainly, you know Enrico from his days as well, serving as CEO and partner of Universal Robots. That was from, I think, 2008 to about 2016. Enrico, you and I have never talked before, so thanks so much for joining us here on the podcast. How are things in Denmark right now?
Well, thank you for inviting me. Things are actually not bad in Denmark as such. If you take say COVID out of the equation, there we have the same challenges as everywhere else. But other than that, I think we have a pretty good business climate at the moment, and a lot of interesting things going on. And yeah, again, from an on-robot business point of view, we can sort of conduct our business in a normal fashion. So it's good.
We were talking before we started recording here. You mentioned it's been difficult to get out of Europe of late. When was the last time you did some traveling for business or personal enjoyment?
Yesterday. but that was within Europe, so I can still go to our and visit our European offices. But the last time I was out of Europe was actually returning from Dallas on March 6 last year. So it's a year now that I have not been able to travel outside of Europe.
I always think back, I've met and chatted with Christian a bunch of times, and I remember having a conversation with him about when you guys were opening the Dallas office, and he talked a lot about the murals that you guys have. Can you tell for folks who don't know that? Is that something? Just tell us the backstory. Is that? Do you have murals at all the offices?
We actually do have them in all the offices. It started in Dallas, and we really liked them. I really liked them. So the lady who did Dallas, I spoke with her, and then we have basically pre-COVID flown her around to all our different offices, and in each office she did one that is partly on robot and partly the local skyline. So this is an easy way now to identify if you are in an on robot office or location.
We'll get to on robot here in a minute. Obviously, you guys are doing some tremendous stuff. Released, I think, 6 products in 2020 alone. I know you just released another one, so we'll get to that in a minute. But again, you and I have never talked, and I always, when I think of you, when I write about On Robot, one of the things that I think about is whether or not you ever think about the impact that you specifically have had on the robotics industry, and in particular, collaborative robots. You know, my colleague, Frank Toby, who I know you know pretty well, I'm sure Frank's listening to this. So Frank, how you doing, sir? You know, he wrote an article about you a few years ago about how you led UR's transition during a very pivotal time in UR's existence. And according to the article, Universal Robots at the time wanted to help their customers customize each of the robots for their respective applications. But you believe that letting integrators and distributors do that hands-on work and provide all the accessories in the customization for the end users was sort of the way to go. Again, seems like a pretty pivotal moment in the company and a large impact on the success that it has since had. Can you just talk about that decision? Like, how did you arrive at that decision?
Yeah, well, how did I arrive at it? I guess that actually comes from my time before Universal Robots, where we had a couple of, say, family businesses manufacturing wood stoves. And there, of course, we actually did a lot of automation and also had some welding robots installed. But it was really difficult, took a long time, and was very expensive to get these robot cells up and running. So I think my view on this is that it has to be easy for the user. So it's not a question of customizing one thing for one user. It's a question of having a system that is easy to sort of adjust to fit any user. And if you want to go to market, if you want to be a global company, then it is very difficult and very expensive if you have to send your own system engineers around the world to do this adjustment at a local end user. So working with the integrators, working with the distributors, that actually allowed UR to grow very fast in global presence with a much smaller, say, financial investment from the company. And then we could bring the ease of use to market much faster, and thereby also create a lot more value for both the partners that we decided to work with, or probably more fair to say the partners who at that time decided to work with us, but also for the end users.
Yeah, sure. I mean, it doesn't sound like, and again, correct me if I'm wrong about any of this stuff, but it didn't sound like UR was maybe in the best of spots financially at that time. And certainly you obviously eventually got support from others, you know, at the company that this was the model to go with. But did you immediately get others on board with that decision, or was there some convincing that had to take place?
There was some convincing. So I joined UR as part of their first sort of real financing round, so to say. And it was the investor who reached out to me. So I basically looked at UR and immediately liked the product. But as you said, I had some challenges with the business model, with the way to go to market. So what I did is basically I said, okay, I like this. I would like to have a look at working with UR, but before doing so, I would like to basically rewrite the strategy and the business plan for the company. So I spent a couple of months doing that and discussing that with the founders and also with the investors. And then when we sort of reached an agreement and say, okay, this is what we can do, we can go globally using a partner model, then I agreed to join the company and sort of also take responsibility of executing that strategy.
How do you see the future of the cobot arm market playing out? Obviously, it's probably become a lot more competitive since those days, a lot more companies trying to get into and break into the market. Universal obviously still holds the majority of the market, mm-hmm. So like 40 to 50%. You guys at On Robot support all of the other leading cobot brands at the time, but How do you see the shakeout playing out here between UR and some of the competition?
I think that UR are definitely in a very good position, but we also see some really, really good new sort of newcomers to the cobot market moving in, and also new companies that are bringing in very good user interfaces, very good technology, and other ways of creating value. I don't think it will be a problem for any of them. I really do believe that the market growth and the market potential is so big that it will leave more than ample space for all the different cobot manufacturers, and also for that matter, for all the say the manufacturers of the lightweight industrial robots. So I don't really think that people, they have to fight for market share here. It's more like a balloon, and working together, we basically just sort of get it filled and expand the surface of the balloon. I mean, expanding the market size. So there will be plenty of business opportunities for everybody.
I listened to a webinar that you were recently a part of, and you had a number, I think it was like 70%, you believe, a majority of the tasks that are done within a typical, you know, manufacturing facility right now can be automated via cobots. So it sounds like, you know, awareness is sort of that main challenge. It's, you know, a topic that I discuss a lot with other folks, but is that still the main challenge? And how do you think COVID-19 has impacted, you know, has it accelerated the awareness, or do you think it will accelerate the adoption of automation?
I think that it will definitely accelerate the adoption of automation. I mean, there are a number of things that people, they are definitely looking at their supply chain and how to make that more stable. Automation will help the social distancing in the factories. There are a number of, say, things that will probably move back to either the US or to Europe, or at least manufacturing that will move within APAC. So all of that opens huge opportunities for all of us who are in the industry. Awareness is still an important part, and we still need to work a lot with the end users to fully make them understand how, say, robotic automation create value for them. So there's also a huge task, but it's also a question of still making it easier. Today, the robots themselves are fairly easy to work with, at least the cobots, but the whole application is still relatively complicated if you are an end user or not a very experienced programmer. So I think in the industry as such, we have a lot of work to do making the development of the applications and the deployment of the applications a whole lot easier than it is today.
I'm actually having a conversation later today with Juan Aparicio. Not sure if you know him, but used to lead the industrial automation group at Siemens. He just yesterday joined Ready Robotics, which is, that's what they're all about, is trying to simplify the programming interface of all different types of, you know, robots. So hopefully we'll have a fruitful discussion about the ease of use. But I want to pivot over to certainly what you're focusing on now at OnRobot, which was formed by, you know, merging three companies and really continues to scale today via acquisitions. It acquired Purple Robotics, a fascinating company. I came across them at Automatica a few years back. You acquired Blue Workforce's IP and some of its employees as well. Was that always the plan, was to grow rapidly via acquisitions, or is that simply a coincidence and that's how things played out?
No, that was actually part of the original strategy founding OnRobot, that we would grow by by acquisitions. So that basically played out according to plan. Now that it was these specific companies were maybe a little bit a coincidence,
Sure.
but the overall say acquisition strategy, that was very much the foundation of OnRobot.
So are you still looking for other acquisitions? I would assume yes.
We are still say monitoring the market, so to say, and I still have a, I don't know if I call it a target list, but something like that. But we have also seen over the past couple of years that some of the companies that we wanted to acquire, maybe they were not as open for acquisition as we wanted them to be. So we have done a lot more in-house development than I originally planned on.
Okay. And I know you can't share, who's on that target list unless you want to feel,
Nah, probably not.
yeah.
Not good for valuation discussions later on.
yeah. Good point. Good point. But obviously, Purple Robotics, very innovative with their electric based, vacuum grippers. I know Preben going back at Blue Workforce and the Ragnar robot and some of the innovations that they developed over there. But what can you tell us about what you're looking to add to the portfolio?
Well, we will be not necessarily by acquisitions. I think that's a little bit difficult to say, but I know if we just look at what we will add, yes, of course, where there are some clearly some tools, some hardware that is still missing in the portfolio in order for us to go out and really make a bid on all the different tasks in the automation industry. So you will be seeing additional hardware from us. You will be seeing a number of tools being launched later this month and also in April and May. Then we will have a, I will not say a complete product portfolio, but something that is getting close to being complete on the hardware side. And then we will actually start moving into much more into software, because that's really where you can add a lot of ease of use, and that is also where you can add a lot of automation to the programming itself. So I see OnRobot much more as a, say, application company, application enabling company than just an end-of-arm tool company.
So selling some sort of kit or package or software focused on palletizing or food applications, specific applications.
Specific applications, but also system monitoring,
Right.
also automatic programming of the applications and so on. So making it really, really easy for everybody involved.
Oh, that's interesting. Well, we'll certainly keep an eye out, and I'm sure we'll pass along the news when you guys are ready to do so. But speaking of the product portfolio, I think when you guys acquired Blue Workforce, you said at that time OnRobot wanted to have about 40 to 50 products on the market by the end of 2020. Now, certainly things happened last year, 2020, with COVID. You guys still have, I think, 17 products I counted on the website. So not quite the goal that you had set out, but pretty impressive nonetheless. What's the key to your development process? I mean, again, just last year, you guys released 6 products. What do you think are the keys to, delivering such high quality products in such in such a, frankly, a short time frame?
A lot of focus and good standardized processes around the whole, say, R&D process, and then a strong strategy also on the product development, so that all engineers, they know exactly what is expected, what is it we want to achieve, and linking that with product management. So there's also a very clear link to market and how we create value. So everything we do is based on customer value creation, and nothing we do is basically based on product features.
I was going to ask you that because I notice a lot of times when OnRobot releases a product, you're obviously quoted in those releases, and you mention our customers told us they wanted X, Y, and Z. So you're obviously working very closely with your customers to develop the products that they need to make their operations run better.
Yes, it's a very, very close cooperation, understanding customer under say needs, understanding what are the challenges, what is it that is difficult for the customers, and then go and do that in a way that the customers they can use. So it's important, I would say, that we don't have engineers developing for engineers. That's probably key.
Yeah. Well, it's a great point, and one that I often bring up. You know, certainly a lot of other companies realize that and have that same mantra, but a lot of companies in the robotics industry don't have that mantra, right? They over engineer things or add things into their product that don't necessarily need to be there because they haven't thought it through well enough, or they haven't had that close communication with the customers.
Yeah, I guess I can only say what we do.
Sure. I want to pick your brain as to what do you think has been the most significant innovation in end of arm tooling of late? I mean, when I think of grippers specifically, I think about soft robotic grippers. Obviously, the company Soft Robotics, I think, was first on the scene with that. There's been some other companies that have followed suit, including OnRobot, which last year released a soft robotic gripper. Again, electric vacuum grippers with Purple Robotics come to mind. What do you think has been the most significant end of arm tooling innovation in recent years?
Are we looking at it? Do you want to look at this from a technical point of view or from a commercial point of view? Because I'm not sure that is the same.
Can we do both? Can we start with technical and then we'll go to the business side?
So I think if we look at it from a technical point of view, I think the Gecko technology is actually opening up for automating a lot of different tasks. So that's a pretty big technical step forward that was not there a few years ago. If we look at it from a commercial point of view, I would actually say it is going electric rather than using compressed air. The savings, so both the environmental impact, but also the financial saving that end users they have using electric end of arm tools is really significant compared to the more traditional tools using compressed air. So I think that's a big step forward.
I think I met, and I'm going to butcher his name. Is it Lasse?
Yes.
One of the co-founders of Purple Robotics. I think I met him at Automatica 2018. Yeah. It was
Lasse Kiefer.
Yeah. Kiefer, yeah. And that was the first time I think I've seen an electric-based vacuum gripper. So I couldn't agree with you more, but talk a little bit more about the Gecko gripper for folks who may not be aware about what you're talking about on the technology side. I think what you're referring to is the adhesive gripper, the adhesion.
It is, yes, and it's. I think here we have a technology that, unlike vacuum, it doesn't leave a mark on the say on the products, on the pieces, work pieces that it moves, and it can also move a lot of things that vacuum cannot move because vacuum would basically pull say false air through PCBs, for instance, would be a good example. So here we are looking at a technology that allows us to handle work pieces in a different way and automate applications that would really not be automated previously. Here we need to build a lot of awareness in the market to make that a commercial success, though.
Can you share, and it doesn't have to be about the Gecko gripper in particular, but perhaps a case study that sticks out to you, and you guys do a great job with the case studies section on the OnRobot website, but can you share a case study that really sticks out to you, perhaps a unique problem OnRobot was part of the solution for?
Yeah, man, I would actually rather not go into and sort of highlight specific, case stories. I think that there are a lot of really good case stories, and to me they sort of all stand out, so I don't think it would be fair to highlight one over the other.
Sure. Okay. So I mean, if anybody listening is interested, again, there's a case studies section on the OnRobot website to check out. One other question about Blue Workforce. So you guys acquired them in April 2019. And at the time, you said there was an opportunity to expand OnRobot's product portfolio with technologies and competencies within soft gripping and vision technologies. And since that acquisition, you've done just that. You've released both the OnRobot Eyes vision system and a soft robotic gripper. How vital was the IP from Blue Workforce in the development of those products, or did it even play a role at all?
Yeah, the IP played a role to a certain extent, but what actually played a much bigger role was the people and the competences we got there. They have been absolutely key. So it's much more people related than it is IP related.
You brought on what, 12? Was it 12 of their employees?
17, I think.
Oh, okay. I'm on that. Okay.
But good yeah. Number.
Yeah, no, that's great. So you mentioned this earlier in our conversation, and I think you said it at the time you left UR and started investing, that you didn't really want to manage as much anymore. But again, you said it earlier, and I assume you're managing quite a lot right now, you know, with all the different people, all the different projects that are going on at OnRobot. What can you tell us? What does the future hold for you? I mean, are you in this for the long haul at OnRobot? Are you grooming someone to sort of take things over? Is there an exit strategy for you? I know, again, going back to the Universal Robot days, some of your partners over there, Thomas Visti, Espen Ostergaard, have sort of stepped away and launched more investing advisory type businesses. You know, what's the future look like for you, Enrico?
I actually think I will be operationally involved for quite some time. You can say, unfortunately, I'm not very good at keeping my mouth shut if I see things that don't work. So sitting on board, so only doing advisory is a little bit difficult. I like to go and grab the things that don't work and then try to fix them. And I'm actually having a lot of fun, not only developing the products, but also the challenge developing the company itself. So I think I'll stay around and have some more fun, and then we will see what happens in the years to come.
Sort of wrap things up here, and again, we've touched on this sort of throughout the conversation. But what do you see being next for End of Arm Tools? What's still missing to continue to improve these technologies, sort of reach the ideal end of arm tool? You mentioned software, you've mentioned ease of use. Just what do you see coming down the pike for not only OnRobot, but also for the end of arm tooling industry as a whole?
That is very much ease of use. And if I should add anything to that, then it's the automatic programming, not only of the tool, not only of the robot, but the automatic programming of the application. I think we will actually move away from discussing robots versus tools and then start talking about applications, because that's where the value creation is. So we will see automatic application development and deployment as the next big thing in the industry.
Well, that would be a huge benefit, I think, to the industry. What can you tell us? What do you mean by automatic programming? You know, I know you can't give away everything, but basically the customers set some sort of parameters around the task at hand, and everything else is figured out via the software.
Yeah, but what do you really need to program? If you look a little bit into the future, you need to know what kind of task that you want to handle, and almost anything else can be automated. Yeah. So when I talk about easy or automated programming, I would say that we will probably see technologies that will reduce the current manual work related to programming reduced by somewhere between 80 and 90%.
Oh, wow.
And if you are an integrator or a distributor in this industry, you can basically turn that around and say, okay, that means that I can sell 10 to 15 times more hardware with the same number of people I have today. And then we can actually support the strong, strong market growth that I talked about earlier today.
So I'll ask you this again. I'm asking Juan the same question later on today. Why has ease of use sort of been put on the back burner from the robotics manufacturer's side of things for so long? I mean, it seems like such a silly thing to not really focus on. You know, as you just alluded to, if you make these things much, much easier to deploy and cut, you know, pivot from one task to the next, yeah, it just opens up that marketplace. But it seems like it's been forgotten about or something that's been significantly overlooked for quite some time.
Yeah, but you have very, very, say, technically capable people sitting in the robot companies and in the end of arm tool companies. You have very technical, capable people sitting at the integrators. So they haven't seen the need, because one engineer was able to understand what the other engineer developed. And I think what we see now is that we understand that we don't have enough engineers. There are not enough people who can really support the potential market growth. So in order to grow the market, we do need to think in a new way that people can work faster and more efficient on the whole application. And I think that's what we are beginning to see, that we begin to see a more market-driven, a more value-driven approach to market compared to a previous feature-driven approach to market.
Where's the first place you're headed once COVID's gone and it's safe and free to travel anywhere in the world? Where are you going to go?
The first country that opened its borders.
So I
have a lot of trips scheduled to different places in both the US but also across Asia. I mean, there are a lot of customers that I haven't seen for a long time, and also a lot of our own people that I have not seen face to face for a long time. So my suitcase is packed and ready to go.
Yeah, the trade show circuit will start up again soon too, right? So I know
that will start as well.
Yeah, and I've been missing those for sure. So, hey, great to talk to you. Thanks again for joining us here on the podcast. Be well, and we look forward to all those announcements coming down the road here from Unrobot.
Lovely. Thank you very much. Thank you.
Let's turn our attention now to the news. And to stay updated on all the latest robotics news, we have you covered with our network of robotics websites. Make sure you check us out at The Robot Report, Robotics Business Review, and Collaborative Robotics Trends. So let's start with our weekly Mars 2020 update. An important week here as the NASA Perseverance rover reached another milestone on the Red Planet. The rover performed a bunch of health checks this week, making sure all of its instruments work properly before it officially heads out and starts getting to work collecting samples on Mars. And for the first time on Mars, the rover was able to move and flex its robotic arm. Of course, probably quite important, quite crucial to the rover's ability to collect those soil samples on Mars. So glad to see that it's working properly at this point in time. NASA is actually holding a news conference on Friday, March 5th at 3:30 p.m. Eastern to update everybody on the status of the Perseverance rover and what's coming next on Mars. So you can watch that press conference in many different places, including NASA's YouTube channel. So the week really started off with a bunch of financial news. Skydio became the first U.S.-based drone company to become a unicorn after it raised a $170 million Series D funding round that actually brought their total funding to date to more than $340 million. And here's why this is really important. The U.S. Interior Department, which oversees federal land and resource management, recently grounded its fleet of 800-plus drones, most of which were developed by Chinese drone companies or manufactured with parts made in China. And they grounded those drones due to cybersecurity concerns. Now, of course, DJI, perhaps the most well-known not only Chinese drone company, but drone company in the world, was not happy with this decision. But previously, well-known drone companies such as 3D Robotics and Sci-Fi Works, just to name a couple, they weren't able to compete with DJI on a cost basis. So Skydio's drones, they're already being tested by the U.S. government for various applications. And again, that banning of Chinese drones could really create a huge runway for Skydio going forward on the commercial side of things. A few other acquisitions to note. Autonomous vehicle company Aurora acquired its second LiDAR startup in less than 2 years. This week it acquired Ours Technology, a 5D LiDAR on a chip company. Aurora said this acquisition will allow it to lower the cost and shrink the overall size of its first LiDAR system. Back in May 2019, Aurora acquired Montana-based Blackmore, also a LiDAR developer, for an undisclosed amount. Aurora is now saying it acquired Blackmore to really improve the technology and focus on LiDAR performance. Now the Ours Technology acquisition will help it scale its in-house LiDAR technology. Perhaps the most interesting acquisition of the week, Accenture. Yes, Accenture acquired Pollux, a Brazil-based provider of industrial robotics and automation solutions. It's the first acquisition of an industrial robotics solutions provider for Accenture. And at first glance, it's kind of a head scratcher, right? A little confusing. Why is a global, services or consulting firm making an acquisition like this? But if you actually take a step back and think about it for a second or two, it actually makes a lot of sense. So Accenture can now come in, they can evaluate an operation, they can analyze how said operation can be improved, and then it can point back to, hey, check out our industrial automation portfolio for potential solutions that can help improve your overall operation. So a good move here for Accenture. An interesting acquisition to watch going forward, Left Hand Robotics, a Colorado-based developer of a multi-purpose robot that can both autonomously plow snow and mow lawns, was acquired by Toro, the large outdoor equipment company. This robot has different attachments that can be swapped in and out depending on the task at hand. Left Hand was founded in 2016. They've raised about $9 million to date. And here's why I think it's interesting to watch. There's not too many, if any, robots like this out there that I know of. There's been a few that have tried to produce a product, a multi-purpose outdoor robot that can plow snow, take care of your lawn, mulch leaves, stuff like that, but really haven't been successful to date. So let's see where this goes. Let's see what Toro can do with it. Let's see if they can scale Left Hand's technology. And finally, earlier this week, drones started delivering COVID-19 vaccines in Ghana. So a pretty cool story here. Zipline sent 4,500 doses of COVID-19 vaccines to 7 different healthcare facilities within districts of Ghana's Ashanti region. Now, this is somewhat of a long-standing relationship here between Ghana and Zipline. They actually first partnered in 2019. And since 2019, Ghana has completed over 50,000 drone deliveries, distributing mainly medical products. They've distributed more than 450,000 medical products and nearly 1 million routine vaccine doses. So vaccine doses for other things besides COVID-19 have already been delivered via drones just in 2020 over in Ghana. So a great example of how drones can be used over in Ghana. And once again, folks, to stay updated on all the latest robotics news we have you covered with our network of robotics sites, make sure you check us out at The Robot Report, Robotics Business Review, and Collaborative Robotics Trends. Let's shift gears here and get into our next interview. So Enrico brought up ease of use frequently in the earlier discussion on the podcast, somewhat unexpectedly. And that's what we'll be discussing here with our next guest as well. We're joined by Juan Aparicio. He's the VP of Product at Ready Robotics. Of course, many of you folks know Juan from his time at Siemens. He spent more than a decade at Siemens leading its advanced manufacturing automation efforts. Founded in 2016, Ready Robotics is building Forge OS. It's a universal operating system designed to make programming robots a lot easier than it's been. So it uses a drag and drop programming interface, which is quite helpful for noobs like myself. Juan, thanks for being here. Does that sound weird to hear? Juan Aparicio, VP of Product at Ready Robotics. Does that sound weird?
Thank you for inviting me. It's quite an honor, and I, you know that I am a big fan of this podcast. It sounds weird, but it sounds also exciting. So both things at the same time.
Yeah, congrats to you again, as we posted yesterday on the Robot Report. A great move by all here. So excited to see how you help Ready Robotics scale its technology. But first off, you know, for those listening who might not know, I gave a brief introduction there about Ready Robotics. But from your perspective, you're 3 days into the job. I know you're an expert on all this stuff already. But tell us, what is Ready Robotics and what is the company trying to do?
Yeah, it's 3 days in a startup. I think they count as 3 months in a normal company. So I will do my best, but I think starting with the mission of the company of really improving the world's quality of life with productivity and through automation, I think that's a really important message that drives everything around here. And if you think about that, in order to achieve that goal, we need to accelerate adoption of robotics and automation, right? But robotics and automation are still very fragmented. I mean, there are more than 70 brands of robots, and that probably doesn't count even the brands from China and Asia. And all of them have their own programming language and interfaces, and they usually require significant training. So the industry also lacks this common ecosystem to foster innovation by building reusable components across brands and developments. And that's where Ready comes in, right? As you said, we have created this Forge OS, which is the first enterprise-grade operating system for robots and automation. And it makes industrial robot brands vastly easier to use and integrate, right? Without sacrificing any functionality, I would say adding more functionality. So that, together with the Ready Academy, which is another very important part of the puzzle, is an incredible resource to learn and skill and reskill, upskill your workforce, learn how to design and deploy any kind of automation, including robotics, and the Ready Market, which makes it easier for any manufacturer to source the components needed to deploy automation. So if you think about that, really, it's a company focused on accelerating the adoption of robotics and automation. And for that, they put all the pieces of the puzzle to have the people trained, being able to be very easy to put an automation system together, and being very easy to program those systems.
I wasn't familiar with the Ready Marketplace. So, you know, doing some prep for this last night, I came across this, and that looks phenomenal. And I know you guys will continue to build that out, but reminds me sort of the, you know, UR Plus ecosystem, right? I know Vention is another up and coming company that helps folks source products from different areas. But a lot of the pieces of the puzzle coming together here for Ready Robotics. I'm curious, were you familiar with them before you joined the company? Did you, in all of your work at Siemens, and I know there was a variety of projects and technologies that you worked on, but did you ever work with them or use the product while you were at Siemens?
I, being honest, I personally hadn't had the chance to work with them at Siemens or use their products. I wish I came across their product when I was designing for Siemens a few years ago, the so-called factory of the future, where we had to integrate different robot brands and automation equipment, like from KUKA, Universal Robot, MagniMotion Conveyors, Orion PLCs. There was so much time I spent on trainings, so much space in the lab for the manuals and whatever. And really, that was fine. But what I wanted to do is that this high-level additional functionality that I couldn't only focus until after I learned all these things. But however, I knew the fantastic work Ready had done with eCAMI. I think a lot of people came across Ready for the first time on that work, which, for those that don't know, eCAMI is a HAAS Technical Education Center based in Kentucky. And there are a lot of coal miners over there that has been displaced by the changing climate policies. And eCAMI teaches these former coal miners and any other person really that is seeking career skills like CNC machining or other advanced manufacturing skills like robotic automation. So at some point they were in a situation that they had to learn these basic robot programming skills, but they didn't want to jump into C++ or Pascal or be locked into a specific brand. So they partnered with Ready because the skills they learned through ForgeOS could be transferred to multiple robot brands. And to me, that was a fantastic example of reskilling and upskilling. And not only on paper, but in reality. Also, the fact that they are based in Ohio, right, in the heart of American manufacturing, that's not super common for startups. Also, I'm still located in California. I see all this ecosystem. A lot of startups are here because the VCs are here. But they made the decision before COVID, right, to be close to their customers and be headquartered there. That was very brave.
I believe they moved, right, because they spun out of Johns Hopkins, so Baltimore area, right? And they picked up and moved to Ohio, right?
Exactly. In 2018, they make the conscious decision, we want to be closer to our customers. So that's a big testimony, right? So that had my curiosity. But then when you look behind the curtain and see what they are working on, their modern software approach to robotics, their open and modular architecture, the manufacturing expertise in the team, right? They had people that were system integrators before or application engineers, and how transformational all of that is, that not only had my curiosity, but also my attention to start discussing joining their team.
Before we move on to the next question here, so we covered the Ready Robotics eCammy story, so we'll link to that in the show notes. I've talked to Kathy Walker, the founder of eCammy, several times. We actually broke the story of them retraining the coal miners, so we'll link to that. Kathy came on the podcast too. So to augment Juan's point, if you guys aren't familiar with what eCammy is doing and trying to reskill some folks who are, you know, down and out by no fault of their own, it's a tremendous operation down there. So we'll make sure to link to our eCammy coverage in the show notes. So, you know, certainly all the different programming languages, you mentioned that a little while ago, you know, most of these robotics companies have their own unique programming language. They also often have an antiquated interface or teach pendant. So those are a couple of the reasons why robots are so difficult to program. And earlier on the podcast, talking with Enrico, he sort of, you know, I asked him the same question, you know, why has ease of use been overlooked for so long from the robotics manufacturer's perspective? And he essentially equated it to, well, you got robotics, you know, you got engineers at the robotics company talking to other engineers or technically inclined folks at the distributors and the integrators who are deploying the systems at the customer sites. And oftentimes the customers are, I don't know if he was alluding to just left out or, you know, they're not, it wasn't a concern of the integrators, distributors, and manufacturers. So I just want to get your perspective on that same question. Why has ease of use been ignored for so long from robotics manufacturers?
There are different reasons, in my opinion. I think I agree with Enrico's point. I think that software was usually overlooked in favor of hardware, right? If you think about that, computers were also very hard to program until we got personal computers or Macs. Most of the robot programming languages trace back to the 80s. And robotics required quite a lot of specialization, and it is a complex discipline, right? Controlling a six-axis or multi-axis piece of machinery is not easy. So why not spending a few several weeks of learning to program this complex piece of equipment? That was, I think, the thought back then. And this in return made robot programming the sole domain of manufacturing engineers and highly trained workers, right? And usually these robots, same than automation, right? They have been very useful for repetitive and precise tasks. So you program it once, and then forget about it from a user perspective, right? So if it breaks, you call this highly trained technician. But there are a lot of people in factories that they're just praying that the robot never breaks. And the same thing with the PLCs, right? I remember going to my first factory visit and saying, okay, what are those? Well, they are controllers, but we never touched them. They were deployed there and God knows what they are doing, but they work, right? So you have these hardware-centric companies, no common standard and a monolithic architecture with no openness that generates vendor locking at the end, right? But now we're in a situation that there are only about 30,000 robotics engineers in the US of around 12 million factory workers. So if you do the math, it's just one robotic engineer for every 11 factories. And on the other side, you want robots to be more flexible, get off their cages, and extend the range of applications where they are used, which involves more interaction points to the user. And those languages just fall short. I think the world of cobots changes slightly that with companies like Rethink or Universal. And even what I consider one of the first examples of really industry 4.0 high level programming with the KUKA's LBR, the Sunrise controller. I had the chance to play a little bit in the past that enabled at least the users to program in Java. I mean, it was a very basic interface, but you could at least program in Java, not something that looks like assembly code. But this no code revolution that we have seen in website or in mobile app productions, which have fundamentally reduced the barriers of entry to really delivering these high skill level capabilities to the masses, it hasn't entered the robotics world until now, right? And there is no really cross brand language, which also limits the innovation that companies can build on top and choosing the best robot for a specific application, right? So we can touch this common platform topic later, but going a little bit to the no code programming, right? There are actually many advantages of that, right? Because if you develop the application yourself, you know exactly how it operates. And going back to that, I'm always amazed how people in factories are extremely afraid to touch this code in case it breaks. And you are self-sufficient, you can troubleshoot problems, change a tool, a product, you can optimize, and you can tap into a community, right? Be more modular and create these reusable assets.
How easy do you think you can get the programming to be? I know there's some other folks working on no code programming initiatives. You know, I think of, and this is a really poor comparison, but I have one of the root robots from iRobot, which uses the Blockly programming. So there's not, and it's for my daughter, 7 years old, but she has no coding experience, no robotics experience. And she's taken to it pretty well, being able to make it, you know, move around and draw and make different designs. But how easy do you foresee the programming of robots becoming, you know, in the future?
So one of the things that I love at my first day at Ready was joining their all hands meeting with all the teams, and they were showing kids from one employee using the system. Like they were probably 10 years old controlling not a cobot, but a big Fanuc robot.
Oh, wow.
That it was behind a fence, but they were playing with the task canvas from Forge. That to me was amazing. That saying, okay, I came to the right place. If a kid can control a big robot, then everybody can do it. And it should be like this, right? High level, we shouldn't be programming motions individually, right? High level, move from here to there, having reusable components on at some point, just saying, pick this object and place it in this other place. With blocks, having the code organized, easy to explain. Obviously, there will be a lot of intelligence hidden to the end user, and that's where these golden nuggets, this magic will happen behind the curtain, and a lot of companies will add value creating those golden nuggets, but they should be just modules, skills that are reusable, and people can just compose in order to create a robotic system, right? Because that's the problem nowadays, that it takes so much time to configure all these communications, all these interfaces, and integrating these systems. That time is not put into the real value for the customer, that is the application itself.
I thought this would be a fun question to ask you based off all the work you've done at Siemens. And, you know, feel free to omit, you know, names of robotic brands if you want. I'm not looking to get you or anybody else in trouble. But what's, you know, since you're focusing on ease of use in programming now at Ready Robotics, what's the most difficult time you've had programming a robot to do something? You know, whether it was during your days at Siemens or maybe it was before that.
That's a good question. As you said, I mean, my time at Siemens Technology, we had projects on, we were doing autonomous coating of Boeing planes, and literally assembling t-shirts, 3D printing with robots. One project that comes to my mind that was so hard and interestingly scoped was doing collaborative bracing. So with Schlumberger. So there is in Schlumberger, this oil and gas company, they have these drill bits that they need to be braced. So there is a bracing operation involving two humans today. That's obviously it's dangerous and it's a lot of it's time consuming and it requires a lot of specialization. So we decided to work, and this was advanced robotics in manufacturing, an ARM funded project. We decided to do a collaborative application. So put the flame in the end of arm tooling of a robot. You can imagine how my EHS person was not happy to hear that I'm going to put flames on robots. But that was super complex because you need to control the flame, the movement of the robot. The robot, obviously, it hit, COVID hit. The robot took time to arrive. So we were using a different robot. Voila, once we wanted to switch to the final robot, there were a lot of, right? We didn't have this common interfaces. You have to redo it again for the new robot. And it wasn't really easy, to the point that I was so happy to see in my last day, some of my team members sent me the robot with the flame for the first time. And I felt, okay, my work here is done. Let's move on. But there is still tons of things to be done. And it's also a testimony sometimes that we think that we need a collaborative robot. Maybe for that application, we didn't need it because the human robot will never touch. They are sharing a space, but they are not really collaborating in that sense.
Yeah.
But that was also part of the parameters of the project. So very exciting, but challenging.
A nice parting gift for you. Is that system working in the real world, or are there videos of that?
It will eventually. And okay. I'm sure to share it. Right now, it's in UC Berkeley in the university, because we have a nice lab over there too, where we put the robot and things.
Got it.
Flames. They have it under control.
I can't wait to see that. So how closely does Ready Robotics work with robotics manufacturers? I mean, you guys are, you're not selling Forge OS to the manufacturers, right? It's an add-on to the end user customer. Do I have that right? And would you ever license Forge OS to these robotics manufacturers?
I think it's a good question. And the answer is yes. I think we would love to do that because I think it's a win-win situation. And I'm still looking from outsider perspective, but just think about that, right? If you are giving, in that scenario, you're giving the robot OEMs access to a no-code programming interface that has taken a lot of time, passion, and resources to develop. Not all the companies, probably the big robot companies, can afford to put those resources, but a lot of them cannot. And also a marketplace, a platform for reusable apps, and the value added that they can offer to the customers, right? So it kind of decouples the hardware and software innovation too. So they can reuse their tremendous robotic expertise into creating probably application for other brands, right? Imagine in the future that Yaskawa can also build applications for palletizing that can run in an ABB. Why not, right? This platform offered that capabilities and that capability, and it unlocks a different game, right? It also enables more specialized robots to pop up and play this game. Other brands that otherwise will have to spend a lot of time developing their software layer, but by licensing Forge, they're already in game and accessing to all these apps from an ecosystem that we want to build.
The reason I ask you that is sort of a segue into the next question, because aren't robotics manufacturers somewhat of a competitor of yours or potentially a competitor? I mean, ABB, as an example, they're the one that comes to mind for me is they recently developed their own graphical programming interface. They call it the Easy Wizard Programming. Now, I don't know, I've never used it, so I don't know actually how easy it is, but it's block-based programming. So, I mean, do you consider things like that to be somewhat of a competitor to what Ready Robotics is doing?
That's a good question. I don't think so. And primarily because it is not a zero-sum game. And this is very important in robotics and automation. And the same happens when people think, okay, robots are stealing people jobs. Right? That's looking into, okay, this is a zero-sum game. You take something and you put something else. But the overall sum is the same. I think this is about expanding the pie and the addressable market. That's the game. Really onshoring manufacturing, getting more robots with more applications, unlocking this industry for innovation from anybody, right? Not only robotic PhDs. And if you think about that, this can only happen with a common ecosystem of platform that enables this cross-platform development. If each OEM has its own programming interface, it still fragments the market. And I'm sure that, just to put an analogy, that Samsung or Xiaomi, they can create beautiful operating systems for their phones. But there is tremendous value in having access to a cross-brand ecosystem like Android, right?
Right.
And imagine a future where we can really mix and match the best in class for a specific application. You choose the robot that you need for your application, and then the path planner for another company, a machine-based controller from company C, another company can provide the camera, and that's easy to integrate, all based on the same foundation. So going back to the question, if you think about that not as a zero-sum game, we all have a lot to gain by having a common ecosystem or platform that enables this and unlocks really the true power of robotics and automation.
Yesterday, Ben Gibbs, one of the co-founders of Ready Robotics, he sent me a video teasing the upcoming release of Forge OS 5. I guess it's coming out sometime this spring. And the video, very well done, whoever you guys hired to do that, or maybe it's an in-house, very slick video. There's an iPad-like device that has apps on it. And you can read, you know, if you zoom in close enough, you can read what those apps are for. They're for welding, sanding and polishing, machine tending, inspection, painting, palletizing, certainly the more common applications that robotics are used for today. So as an app store, it's often been talked about in the robotics industry that is, you know, something that is much needed. Sounds like, is that already something that exists or building out a more robust app store? Sounds like it's certainly part of the plan going forward.
I think I agree with you that it's really incredible to see what the team is building. And it's built on years of success in real production environments and customer requirements. And Forge OS 5 is really built from the ground up to facilitate this third-party development of automation apps. So that, right, apps that can extend across all major robot brands really impact robotic automation at the scale, right? In manufacturing and beyond, right? The way I see it is the platform for robotic developers that want to see their innovation scale and really giving them a commercial route that was never possible, right? We talk about the no-code robotic programming as one part of the puzzle that will democratize robotics, but really, enabling an ecosystem independent of hardware where advances in software, machine learning, and AI can be applied to every robot brand at the scale, not just the one that the developer utilized in their original work, right? I have seen so many startups around here in Silicon Valley. They start developing their application, super cool. Usually they choose a universal robot because it's easier. And then, okay, now I have to... My customer is asking me for Hanuk, what do I do, right? I need to rewrite the drivers and start from scratch. And that time can be put really on the high level. We want companies focusing on the part of robotics that creates innovation, not the data logging, not making components communicate, right? But the golden nuggets that really provide value to the customers, more flexible bin picking, machine tending, the palletizing, the autonomous painting, you name it, right? So this will be also a very important part of the puzzle in democratizing robotics.
So can you walk us through an example of how one of those apps works? You know, just take machine tending, for example. How does Ready's, you know, app work? Is it the user essentially has to tell the system, you know, here are the components that we have. We have a UR arm, we have a Intel RealSense camera here, you know, put the system into somewhat of position. And, you know, this is the machine tending task that we're trying to do. And then you guys on the back end are figuring out all the other pieces of the puzzle and making it happen. Is that what happens?
You describe it perfectly. So little less to add, but everything modular in a sense I have a new component that I add, a new device that I add. I can, if you think about that, like subscribe or to their feeds and then build my application on top of that. Some things with the real robot, some things with the interface, easy parameters that may vary from application to application. Now you have done a machine tending, for example, right? It's a good example. You have your parts presented. Tomorrow you have different parts, so you can update your code. You don't need to call your the technician. It's just changing a few starting points where the robot will start picking, and then the end goal, then it should be working right away. Tomorrow you have a different robot, different station. You don't have to start from scratch. You just reuse your code. In the future, you want also that the robot picks from a bin pick instead of a organized one. And a third party, a startup has that functionality. Imagine that scenario, right? Then it's another app that you add and integrate in your system. And voila, now you can also pick from this unstructured environment. So that's the goal, right? I'm not saying this will be there from day one, but if you think about that, we have had that Windows moment, that Android moment, that hasn't happened in robotics. But manufacturing, really automating stuff, can be bigger than web, can be bigger than mobile, can be the biggest market on earth for developers to start innovating. If we really unlock that and open that door for anybody, not just people with robotics PhD, but maybe the people with a machine learning background, people with UX background or other backgrounds that can and want jump into this cool wagon that is moving at full speed right now, even more after COVID.
You guys are creating magic over there is basically what you're doing. Speaking of COVID, how is it accelerating things? I mean, I think I know the answer, but, you know, talking with a lot of other experts in the field, obviously COVID's a terrible, terrible thing for many reasons. I like to preface that, saying that, but for robotics and automation seems to be certainly pushing awareness, pushing the understanding of the benefits that automation can bring to companies. You agree with that sentiment?
I fully agree. Yeah, it was horrible. It has given us the realization that it wasn't a super powerful AI or robot that put humanity to our needs, right? That really stole our jobs, that it was a virus. Right, and when we needed robots and automation the most to be flexible, to scale up, down, change quickly, that didn't happen, right? So it has really pressed the fast forward button on digitalization, robotics and automation. And it has also exposed critical flaws in our manufacturing operations, right? We over rely on people. We have a high degree of geographic dependence. Really shipping things back and forth across the world probably wasn't the best idea to start with. We need to start resorting. And this inability to scale up, down, change quickly, right? And a failure, really a failure to maintain this diverse supply chains that stop a lot of things. We have learned. And I think now the industry is really fully ready to embrace this change, move full ahead on automating and adding more robots, and we need to add the technology to facilitate that. And that's also one of the motivations of joining such a company, is to really make that easier, right? Automation needs to be simpler to apply, simpler to connect, and much simpler to run.
It's almost, you bring up a great point. it's the supply chain, you know, that certainly was exposed. The manufacturing was certainly exposed, specifically around the PPE, right? Uh-huh. Early on when the pandemic hit. But it almost doesn't make sense that we're shipping all this stuff from so far away. And hyperlocal manufacturing is, you know, a term that's been thrown out there. And I saw a meme the other day on social media, and it somewhat relates. It's about mailing, you know, physically mailing a letter or an invitation or something across the country, and just how it doesn't make sense anymore. It's like we're in 2021. It's such an antiquated idea to have to walk to a mailbox, you know, put something in there, wait for someone else to come empty that mailbox, bring the letters or the bills or whatever it is to the post office. Somebody sorts that, and then that stuff gets shipped all the way across the country just for someone to, you know, open up a letter and throw it away or something like that. It's just, yeah. It really doesn't make any sense. And it's almost like manufacturing is almost not to that extent, but it's just so inefficient.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. That we ship fish that we capture here to the overseas to China to de-skin it and then back, or that we are the biggest exporter of cotton in the world, but then importer of finished goods, all the things from metals and other things. We have the resources and the technical capabilities in this country, for example, to really start resorting and empowering our workers and manufacturing. I mean, it's also tells a story a little bit on the when I started here in Silicon Valley 5 years ago. I mean, the hype was autonomous cars, right? Nobody thought of steel manufacturing was cool. It was done somewhere else, right, overseas. So, but that sentiment, I think, has changed. As a matter of fact, a lot of these professors that I was interacting with and trying to convince to work with us, now they have their own startups in this space. It's not one of these kind of melancholic Bruce Springsteen songs of manufacturing. You go to a factory and they are clean spaces full of machines, and innovation opportunities, right? So it's all about how can we really make this so simple that everybody can start adding innovation here and see it as the really cool and sexy industry that it really is, right? It's producing stuff in big quantities with a high degree of customization in the future and more flexibility. That's an amazing opportunity.
Yeah, just to bring it back to eCammy, you know, that's part of the pitch there is you get to work with these high tech machines, right? These things are, you know, who doesn't love technology, right? I think people are generally unaware about the amount of technology that's involved in the manufacturing process. So I think, getting the word out on that is certainly a challenging thing to do, but hopefully we'll get there someday. But so, you know, obviously we've talked a lot about ease of use in from the simplifying programming standpoint, but what other innovations, what are some other innovations, improvements that can be made to help democratize robotics?
So there are different parts of the puzzle. This really no-code robotic programming is one of them, enabling this ecosystem independent of hardware, where really the advances in software, machine learning, and AI can be applied to every robot brand at scale. That's the other part of things that we also touch, right? And really hammering that by using these modular and modern software architectures that abstract the underlying hardware, suddenly the biggest developer market on earth, bigger than mobile on earth, which is producing and automating stuff, gets unlocked, right? This really opens the door for non-traditional roboticists or engineers to innovate in this space. There is a third part of the equation that is also the lowering the cost on the hardware side of things, right? Eventually getting robot arms for less than $10,000 or even $5,000, that will have an incredible accelerating effect. So more robots, easier to use, more flexible thanks to artificial intelligence with a common platform to build on top. And we have seen this picture before in PCs and mobile, right? Robotics, again, hasn't had its Windows or Android moment yet, but companies like Ready are positioned to change that. And just think about also outside manufacturing, right? Manufacturing is definitely where most of the robots have been placed. Service robotics are also increasing. I had the anecdote, or a member of my team before at Siemens had a robot at his house as to one of these arms to shoot cool YouTube videos. So that also creative space, right? If I have the chance to, what do I buy, a new Tesla or a new robot for my garage? It would be a tough question, at least tough conversation to have with my wife. But on the other side, imagine that this thing costs $5,000 and you are an influencer or someone that wants to create content for unboxing, for boxing, for doing things, also photography, things like this, right? That are outside the normal usage for robots. And now you have a very easy to use robot that costs $5,000. Then it starts getting interesting, right? Because you can automate a lot of stuff, you can control, get all these good characteristics of a robot, of repeatability, of automating things. And now you are running the show with a robot. How cool is that, right? We will get there, right? You're seeing just a few people there, but the moment that really, I think now the number of robots worldwide that we have seen is how much, around 400,000. Imagine that we get to put another zero, right? 4 million. That would be awesome, right?
I think what I heard there is there's an Aparicio YouTube channel coming. Is that what I heard there? An unboxing channel?
Soon enough, yeah. I want to be an influencer of robotics doing cool stuff. But just imagine, like, even unboxing stuff with photography where the camera follows you. This is something very, very interesting. That is only, and there are a lot of professional studios already using robots. Now put that in the hands of the common folks. That would be amazing. Yes, that's just one example.
Yeah. Oh, I would say you're an influencer in your own way within the robotics industry. So don't sell yourself short. But one other question I wanted to ask you, we had Enrico on earlier. They're focusing on end of arm tooling, robotic grippers to help robots better grasp a wider variety of objects. And that's certainly been a focus of yours as well in the past. How would you characterize the current ability of robots to manipulate objects, you know, perhaps that they haven't seen before?
Always the taxonomy of robot grasping is still highly surprising and interesting for a lot of people, and a very interesting area, right? Objects or situations that look exactly the same, that for a human it will be no different, it makes a big difference for a robot, right? If you cannot control the light, if suddenly something is wrapped on a piece of plastic, it makes a big difference, right, for a robot. And the nice thing that is happening is that sensors are getting cheaper. There are companies like Intel with their new LiDARs, L515, or the RealSense before, that put really good depth cameras for a few $100. So that facilitates a lot because, I mean, let's be also realistic, having better sensors help a lot. There is still a frontier to cross in tactile sensing. There will be a lot of companies going there in order to really emulate the capabilities of a human. So you start having all the pieces of the puzzle, right? You have cheaper sensors, good AI models that can now also generalize to different objects. And to be honest, also I always thought that the grippers haven't innovated for a long time, these two-finger grippers, until I found this video of a PR2 that cannot be a more clumsy gripper, just cleaning an entire room. It was teleoperated, right? But it could clean the entire room. So I don't think the bottleneck is there. Now, the question is, do we need 100% reliability and accuracy when we are picking something, when we are manipulating? And my answer is probably no, right? I think it is okay to add humans for corner cases. And also think outside the box. I mean, we always think, okay, one robot is equal to one human, so we compare the speed. But in that scenario that I was mentioning before, where robots are cheaper, why not using also two arms, because we also have two arms, or even more, right? If it makes more sense for speed. So going back to your question, picking everything at home with varying degrees of lighting and any object, we are probably not close. Picking everything in a control environment with tool changers and humans for these corner cases, 1 in 1,000. That can be achieved today. And it's actually radically changing e-commerce. So we are seeing a lot of these solutions already deployed at the customer side. And there are companies like Covarian, even Siemens, also companies like Plus One Robotics that do an excellent job with this human-robot interaction, right? And I think it's something that, again, today we are much closer than before.
We had Eric Nieves from Plus One Robotics on the podcast a long time ago. He talked a lot about human in the loop and, you know, sort of taking that approach. Well, hey, this has been a great conversation. I'm glad to finally get you on the podcast. I know you've listened, and I appreciate the support. Any final, you know, closing thoughts on, you know, what we should be watching, whether it's for Ready Robotics or overall just sort of the democratization of robotics going forward?
Yeah, again, thank you for inviting me. It has been an honor to discuss and so much fun. It's always super interesting to discuss these topics. I will say that we are at the verge of a real Cambrian explosion. If you think what happened during the Cambrian times, that it was an explosion of life, but we are going to see an explosion of robotic application. We are seeing that also outside cages, service robotics, robots that do serve you coffee, that serve you, that clean your dishes in a more restaurant or hotel fashion, and the same thing in manufacturing, right? There is a big change coming. I want to also emphasize that we should do everything that we can to put more robots in the hands of more people, not making something exclusive to a few, but make it so easy that everybody can interact with this beautiful piece of machines, but they are robots. And it's all about unlocking this power of robotics and automation that we have only grasped a little bit, right? I think robotics is flourishing after COVID. We'll continue robotics and automation, but we will see a bloom. We'll see a bloom sooner than later. It's all about working together, collaborating. This is not a zero-sum game. I don't think there are really competitors in this space. It's all about, let's make this pie as big as we can, and we will all succeed. And I think Ready has the key to not only unleash this true power of automation in 10 years, but today. This is a very tangible goal that will generate tremendous impact. And really putting humans in the center, don't forgetting about them, and how do we put these robots in the hands of more people? That will be so powerful. So if this also resonates with your mission, with the kind of things that you are trying to do at your company, let's have a talk, reach out. And as I said, let's make this robotics pie as big as possible.
Yeah, I couldn't agree with you more about getting these systems into the hands of more people. It's really the key, you know, sort of lower. There's a lot of, whether or not we want to admit it, there's a lot of people who are fearful of these things. I think once they get an intimate understanding of how they work, I think that fear goes away. So, hey, we'll be watching for sure the upcoming release of Forge OS 5. I'll certainly be waiting for your YouTube channel to launch. I'll be one of your first subscribers. Juan Aparicio, VP of Product at Ready Robotics, thanks for joining us, and come back anytime, sir. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
That's going to do it for episode 37 of the Robot Report podcast. Thanks again to Enrico and Juan for joining the program today. And of course, thanks to all of you for tuning in. New episodes of the podcast drop every week. You can find us on Amazon Music, Apple Podcasts, Google Play, SoundCloud, Spotify, anywhere you get your podcast. Please subscribe, leave us a rating, give us a review. And don't forget, folks, to check out our Robo Business Direct series, which continues March 18th. Join DHL, Intel, Waypoint Robotics, and yours truly for a discussion about scaling autonomous mobile robots from pilots to fleets. It all kicks off at 2 p.m. Eastern, again, March 18th. To register and check out the full schedule, visit robobusinessdirect.com. Have a great weekend, everybody. We'll talk to you again next week. Take care.